Well, the calendar has ticked over to December, which means that Christmas mustn't be too far away. Of course, there have been hints and indicators of this in our shopping malls and pop-up ads for months. But once the calendar reads December, we know it's finally really close at hand. As we enter the period of time known as Advent, it's worth reflecting on how we can prepare for Christmas as followers of Jesus. Welcome to the GBC Sermon Podcast, a weekly message from Gamia Baptist Church in Sydney, Australia. I'm Mark Rader, Senior Pastor here at GBC, and I trust that you'll hear the invitation of the Holy Spirit to join in God's work in your life and world in this message. This week, we begin a new series entitled Ring the Bells, in which we will seek to answer the questions, what is Christmas really about, and what difference does that meaning make?
Today's reading is from Isaiah 2, verses 1 through to 5. This is what Isaiah, son of Amoz, saw concerning Judah and Jerusalem. In the last days, the mountain of the Lord's temple will be established. As the highest of the mountains, it will be exalted above the hills, and all nations will stream to it. Many peoples will come and say, "Come, let us go to the mountain of the Lord, to the temple of the God of Jacob. He will teach us his ways, so that we may walk in his paths." The law will go out from Zion, the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. He will judge between the nations and will settle disputes for many peoples. They will beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation will not take up sword against nation, nor will they train for war anymore. Come, descendants of Jacob, let us walk in the light of the Lord.
It's good to have you with us this morning as we head into Christmas. One of our favorite films as a family is The Grinch, starring Jim Carrey. It's kind of part of our Christmas routine. We quote along with it, and kind of I'm already looking forward to watching it again. But there's a scene in the movie when the Grinch, who's dressed up as Saint Nick, is in the middle of stealing the Who's Christmas when he is interrupted by small Cindy Lou Who. After telling her a little fib about why he's stuffing their Christmas tree up the chimney and taking it all away, she asks him this really important question. She says, "What's Christmas really about?" And his first response is vengeance, which I think is funny. And then when she kind of goes, "That's awkward," he redacts himself and says, "Well, presents, I suppose." To which she responds, "I was afraid of that." It's a really good question, isn't it? What's Christmas really about? And the reason why it's such a good question is because our behaviors, our actions are driven by what we believe, right? You ever wonder why you're so tired at Christmas? I mean, there's lots of different reasons, aren't there? I mean, it's the end of our year, and so school's finishing, and all the kids' activities are done, and so we've got end of year this and end of year that, and it's all that kind of stuff. Some of us have been saving up our holidays for January, and so we're kind of at the end of our tether anyways, as we kind of wait for our leave and in the summer break and whatever it might be. But I think one of the reasons that we are so wearied at Christmas is actually because we have not answered the question, what is Christmas really about? And so we allow all sorts of competing narratives to drive our actions. So think about some of the narratives of Christmas. What's Christmas really all about? Well, some would say that Christmas is about maintaining a childlike innocence and a naive wonder in the mystery of Christmas, right? And we can expend an enormous amount of energy trying to maintain and guard innocence wherever we find it. Another competing narrative is that Christmas is about friends and family and loved ones. And so what do we do? Well, we jam-pack our holiday calendars with meetings and greetings and drinks and dinner with every single person we haven't seen since last December, right? Others would say that Christmas is about presents, or if you're more cynical, the economy, all right? And so we spend and spend and spend and spend, in part because of another competing narrative, which is that Christmas is the most wonderful time of the year. And if Christmas is to be the most wonderful time of the year, then we need to make sure that Christmas Day is extra, 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 extra special, which is really complicated now because we live in such a wealthy, privileged place that nearly every single day of our lives is already extra special, right? And so we end up driven by all of these beliefs about what Christmas is about until we fall over the line on Christmas Day. That's why you're so tired at Christmas. You're welcome. Huh? So the question is, what is Christmas really about? And this series, Ring the Bells, is an opportunity for us to explore the answer to that question, and perhaps more importantly, I hope, to get to some of the practical behaviors that our belief ought to actually drive. How ought we to live at Christmas? How can we celebrate Christmas without becoming kind of the bah humbug Scrooge types who just ignore the whole thing? How can we embrace this season while at the same time doing so in a way that reflects what we really believe about the season itself? So over the next few weeks and then leading through Christmas itself, we're actually going to be following the lectionary readings for the season of Advent. Some of you from an Anglican background going, oh, I'm home. Others of you kind of going, we're doing what from a hooby-woody? So let me explain. Advent is the church season, and I say church capital C, in the lead up to Christmas. It's been celebrated for centuries. The four Sundays before Christmas is an opportunity for those who follow Jesus to prepare their hearts for the first coming of Jesus. That's the season of Advent. The lectionary is a cycle of 3 years in which most of the Bible is read, and many churches would still use the lectionary today. They would have a lectionary reading from the Old Testament and from the Psalms and from the Gospels and from the Epistles, and then generally speaking, a preacher might choose one or more of those to preach from. We're going to be choosing to preach on the passages in Isaiah that make up the lectionary readings of Advent. You all with me? As Baptists, we're just like edging out into the liturgical deep waters right now. Not really, we're not. So if you have your Bibles with you, turn to Isaiah chapter 2. And as you're looking that up, whether it's in a hard copy or soft copy, let me give you just a little bit of background to make some sense of what we're going to encounter here. Because it's easy when we read the prophets to kind of forget or really to not really be aware of how important the prophetic voice was in the ancient world. We kind of get a little bit sidetracked by John the Baptist with his whole camel skin wearing, bugs and honey approach to life, living out in the wilderness somewhere. And we kind of think that prophets are kind of the ancient equivalent of someone wearing a sandwich board, waving a big King James Version Bible and shouting at a megaphone at whoever's passing by. That's not actually a very good way to think about the prophets. The prophets were more like front bench members of parliament. They moved in corridors of power. You routinely find the prophets speaking to kings. And lunatics on the edge of society don't get to approach the king. Like, that's not how that works. So prophets spoke into the very heart of government about the most important things in government. The prophets were not just there to say, oh, hey, listen, we need to make sure that the worship of the Lord is right. They spoke into matters of foreign policy. They spoke into matters of kind of internal national policy. They talked into matters of labor and economics and the whole kit and caboodle. And so Isaiah is speaking on behalf of the Lord into those sorts of scenarios. And when Isaiah was ministering, it was the 8th century, so the kind of low 700s, high 600s BC, and he was speaking in a period of time when the kings of Israel and the people of Israel needed the voice of God because their world was changing. It's not as if their world was immune to the movements of nations. And in the mid-8th century, there was this kind of mini golden age. There was peace, and with peace comes prosperity, and with prosperity comes all the luxuries of life, right? We know how that whole system works. And as the 8th century was coming to a close, that all began to collapse. Because one of the features of their little mini golden age was that the two superpowers that controlled that whole territory, Egypt in the south and Assyria to the north, had been in decline. And because they were in decline, the countries in the middle were able to flourish. And all of a sudden, in the 8th century, the Assyrians rose again. And this time, not just content to rule their own territory, but they wanted to expand and create an empire that would extend eventually all the way to Egypt. In fact, by the end of Isaiah's ministry, the border of the Assyrian Empire was probably only about a dozen kilometers away from Jerusalem. So their foreign policy, how they were to relate to this superpower, how they were to relate to the nations around them, who they were to trust, became incredibly pressing issues that Isaiah is speaking into. And it's into that space that his book is then introduced for us. I think I've given you enough time to find Isaiah 2, right? So in Isaiah chapter 1 and 2, we have kind of a part 1a and a part 1b introducing the book of Isaiah, basically giving us a summary of what we're going to encounter. Chapter 1 and 2 both start with a reference to Isaiah, son of Amos, where he ministered, Judah and Jerusalem, and reference to the vision that he saw, the things that he saw in relationship to his people. In chapter 1, we have an account of God's perspective on the people and how they have basically, in the midst of all of the peace and all of the prosperity and all of their success and all of the luxury, they have not allowed their hearts to follow after God. And so while on the outside, everything looked fantastic. I mean, if you had wandered into Jerusalem in this period of time, the temple would have been pumping. It would have been busy day in and day out, all the right sacrifices in all the right ways, with all the right trimmings and trappings. It would have looked spectacular. And God's response is, it is completely and utterly empty worship because your hearts are not in it. Your actions aren't in it. Your behaviors do not align at all with the things that are pleasing to me. So that's the first chapter. In chapter 2, however, we have the other half of this message. So there's judgment that's coming, and then there's a new future. And this future is a fairly spectacular one. So if you want to look in chapter 2, starting in verse 2, where Isaiah references the last days. And he's not talking about the end of the world last days. He's talking about some future time in history. Because what he describes is not heaven. He describes earth. He describes something happening in the world. And here's his description. In the last days, the mountain of the Lord's temple will be established as the highest of the mountains. It will be exalted above the hills, and all nations will stream to it. Now, in the ancient world, temples were often built on hills or mountains. Not only were they kind of the highest place so people could see them, but there was a sense that they're kind of closer to God, right? Or to the gods, as it might be. And so there's an idea here of the temple of the Lord being exalted. But it's not meant as a literal seismic action where the mountain of God just grows and grows and grows and grows and grows until everyone can see it. What this is talking about is the significance of the temple as a place for people to come. A couple weeks ago, I was at a presentation by McCrindle, who does a whole bunch of social research, and the NCLS, National Church Life Survey, who also do a whole bunch of research into church life. And they were speaking about the shifts in demographics and things that are taking place for us that we need to be aware of as we lead churches and engage with our community. It was really interesting stuff. But at one point, they started by talking about the differences between, and we were in Parramatta at the time, between Parramatta now and Parramatta, I think it was 80 years ago. And these changes are reflected everywhere in Sydney and across Australia. The biggest shift is from the urban areas from the rural areas to the urban areas, right? That's the biggest shift that's taken place. More and more and more people are living in cities, right? You know this. This is the reality of our world, right? To some degree, we could say in Isaiah chapter 2 that a city like Sydney, or more specifically on this thing, North Parramatta, had become exalted above the hills, right? It had become more important, drawing more people to it because there was more opportunity for work and more educational infrastructure and more of everything, and it draws people to it. You with me? So this is talking about a day when the temple will not just be really grand and on a big hill, but where the temple of the Lord and all that it symbolizes, where heaven and earth meet, it will become so significant that people will stream to it from all nations. Now, we kind of miss the significance of the word streaming. You ask a younger congregation about streaming, and they're going to ask what the Wi-Fi password is, right? But in this case, we're talking about like water, right? It's a water image. And it's interesting, isn't it, that the nations will actually stream up to God. This is a grand reversal of our world, where not only is it not just the people of God, it's the nations, but they will stream up. Water will run uphill in the day to come. In those last days, when God does something miraculous, the whole world is going to be drawn to the temple. They're going to be drawn to the temple like people are drawn to cities today, because it has the answers. It has the opportunities. It has all the benefits. It has everything you need, and people are always drawn to that, right? This is the image that Isaiah has of the mountain of the Lord. Many people will come and they will say, verse 3, "Come, let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the temple of the God of Jacob. He will teach us his ways so that we may walk in his paths. The law will go out from Zion, the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. He will judge between the nations and will settle disputes for many peoples. They will beat their swords into plowshares, their spears into pruning hooks. Nation will not take up sword against nation, nor will they train for war anymore." Do you hear the language of reversal all the way through it? Not only are the nations streaming to the mountain of God because it has everything that they ever want, but they're not being drawn. God is not pulling people to him. No, they are streaming to him. Just as water runs really easily downhill, people will be drawn to him. And their heart desire will be what? Teach us your ways. Chapter 1, if we had time to explore it, is the story of God's people who should have known his ways and did not. And in the glorious future, the nations will long to be shown the ways of God that they might walk in his paths. And when they do, well, the reversals continue. In a passage that's repeated in Micah chapter 4, we hear that the implements of war will no longer be necessary. And just think about that. It means that the justice that is dispensed is so complete, so total, that no one anywhere has any thought of any more vengeance or needing anything more to make it right. It will be so right that no one will need the implements of war. I don't know if this is the first biblical example of a recycling program, but it's got to be pretty close. Because what are we going to do with all these swords and spears and stuff? Well, we'll make them into something useful. And what's useful in this new age? Agriculture, plowshares, pruning hooks. And if you remember the grand story of God, where does the story of God begin? In a garden, where humanity, without conflict and without violence and without greed and without all that stuff, live in a garden in the presence of God, walking in his paths. Here is another promise of God to make it right. So yes, currently my people are struggling to remain faithful, and yes, there will be judgment and discipline, but that is not the end of the story. Now, from here, I'd like to think that it'd be fairly easy to see how this lands with Jesus, right? We believe that the whole Bible points to Jesus. Jesus believed that about himself. He was always telling people how everything in the Old Testament pointed to him, right? Only person who's going to get away with that, right? You might remember, though, when he was arrested, one of the accusations that stuck was his declaration that I will destroy the temple and rebuild it in 3 days. Right? Remember that accusation against Jesus? I will destroy the temple and rebuild it in 3 days. Now, the 3 days lets us know that what Jesus was restoring is his own body. But what he's saying then is that he is going to become the temple. He is going to become the place where God meets humanity and where humanity meet God. He is going to become not a place, but a person where we can encounter God in fullness. And therefore, we no longer need a building of bricks and mortar that you have to travel to. No, Jesus has come to us. And he has become the person through whom we encounter God. And what has happened in the last 2,000 years? But that people have been streaming to him, have they not? Streaming to him and asking, "Will you show us your ways that we may walk in your paths?" This is how this passage is fulfilled and points to Jesus. Don't know if you've ever heard the term desire lines before. I don't remember how I bumped into it, but I was sure glad I did because it's been useful for a couple of sermon illustrations. Desire lines, you've seen them even if you don't know the term. Whenever you go to a park or a public space, and there are those wonderful paths that have been tiled or paved for you. The desire line is the dirt track that people actually use. It's usually a little bit shorter, a little bit more convenient, whatever it might be, right? And it's the desire line, right? And I believe the whole idea of designing public spaces is to make sure that you pave and make paths where the desire lines are, lest you allow people to create one. And I found it a really helpful analogy, and I think for what's happening here. Because for the people of God, for the people who were supposed to live in his ways, who were supposed to walk in his ways, they were instead not walking on the paths that God had designed for them in his wisdom and in his knowledge and in his love for humanity. Instead, they were following what? The desire lines of their hearts. Shortcuts, cutting corners, finding a way that feels a little bit more convenient, but is not nearly as smooth, is not nearly as nice, is not nearly as well designed as the paths that have actually been laid out for us. And if the people of God struggled to follow the paths that God set out, how much more so the nations? So what do we find here? What we find here is a promise in the future that the desire lines of our hearts will actually be changed and brought into alignment with the paths that God has in store for us. Won't that be a great future? Where our paths align with God's desires and where we want to walk in the ways that he has set out for us. This is the vision that Isaiah has. So the question is, what does this have to do with Christmas? Well, I think there's a couple of things that I think are really quite significant for us about this story that we find fulfilled in part in what Jesus has done. The first is this. What we believe about Christmas is that it is not the end of the story, but the beginning of a new chapter within it. And that's really important for us. Most of the stories of Christmas that we are told, because they started in September, feel like they go on forever, right? But they all culminate on December 25th, don't they? And so we ratchet up, we ratchet up, we ratchet up, and just hope we can get to the 25th. Possibly Boxing Day if you have extended family. And then you fall over the line and hope to get down the coast, right? Isn't that how the whole story works? So Christmas is the finish line, and we go, oh, we've made it. What we believe in Jesus' coming is that Christmas marks the start of something new. It's the new chapter in God's ongoing plans to restore the world. Did you like that new song that we sang today? King of Kings? I love it. Not only because it starts with Christmas and ends at Easter, which is really good theology, and it's got some Trinitarian stuff thrown in there as well. I love how they've framed up the plans of God, right? We're going to sing it again at the end, right? To reveal the kingdom coming and to reconcile the lost, to redeem the whole creation, you did not despise the cross. That's it. That's why Jesus came. And so if we just get to December 25th and go, whew, we're done, we've missed the point. And so the implication for our lives is, I think, to ask, how can Christmas be more sustainable? How can it be more sustainable for us? How can we practice Christmas in a way that doesn't completely just smash us? I don't want to be corny, but there's something to that song, I wish it could be Christmas every day. Because we believe that Jesus has come to make a difference every day. And so how can we make a Christmas sustainable? How can we turn the volume down a little bit on just how much we do so that we're always involved in giving, that we're always involved in sharing, that we're always involved in showing our love and affection to those around us, that we're always looking out for those around us? I think that's one really important implication. But the second is this, and this is perhaps, this is what I love most about what we believe about Christmas. Jesus' birth allows us, in a way that no other Christmas narrative does, allows us to look at the brokenness and twistedness of our world and say, you will not win. You follow me on that? No other Christmas story has such a grand scope. No other Christmas story can really cope with looking at our world dead in the eye and looking at all the busted, broken muck that surrounds us. Now, why do we try to celebrate innocence? In part because we don't want anybody to talk about that rubbish. We give to charity at Christmas so we kind of feel a little bit better about ourselves. But we don't give any thought to the wastefulness of our Christmases or to any of that kind of stuff. We just kind of, It's technical. It's a Greek term. It's somewhere in the back. Loose translation. The story of Jesus allows us to look at the brokenness of our world and declare, you will not win. And that has enormous implications for how we celebrate Christmas. Because we can look greed in the eye and say to greed, you will not win. And what do we see all around us? At Christmas? And so we have the invitation of the Holy Spirit to say, how am I going to undermine and subvert the victory of greed? Apathy. We can look apathy dead in the eye and say, you will not win. We can look at arrogance and say, you will not win. At violence, at lust, at rage, or whatever it is, and say, you will not win. And then try in some way, shape, or form to live out our preparation for Christmas in a way that subverts and undermines the supposed victory of all that is wrong in our world. So by all means, share gifts and presents with those around you, but not as a way to prop up the system, but as a way to subvert our world. Do not give in to greed and wastefulness because that's just the story that we believe. No, make a decision about what it is that the Holy Spirit is inviting you into. Make sure you are finding some kind of charity to give to. I know many of you supported Hope Field, and thank you for that. But make sure that you do that. You want to pray a risky prayer? Ask the Holy Spirit to set your Christmas budget this year. Ask Him for a number. Ask Him for a figure. And when you ask for two: what you are going to spend on yourself and your family, and what you are going to give away. You want a risky prayer? There it is. Because Jesus' coming means that our story is just a continuation. And our celebration of Christmas ought to be sustainable. We should be filled with the peace and hope and joy of Jesus' coming, not sharing with everyone else the weariness of the whole season. Getting to Boxing Day and going, oh, I'm glad that's over. Because the day will come, Isaiah says. I see it. When people will stream to Jesus and say, show me your ways. And how does this little passage end? Well, we're not there yet, Isaiah says. We got all the rubbish of chapter 1 to work out. We have a glorious future to look forward to. So what do we do between now and then? Come, descendants of Jacob, people of God, let us walk in the light of the Lord. Between now and that glorious future, let us seek to align the desire lines of our heart with the paths of the one we follow. And if we can do that at Christmas time, I reckon people will be pretty interested in how we've managed to do that. They'll be asking some questions.
The birth of Jesus that we celebrate at Christmas is a new chapter in the plans of God to redeem the whole of creation. As such, our preparation for Christmas should be both sustainable and filled with hope. A hope that comes from trusting in God's promises that the darkness of our world will not win. Do your practices at Christmas reflect this hope? Is there someone you know who needs to hear this message too? And if so, why not share it with them and see what God does through that? As always, we'd love to hear from you as you hear and respond to the invitation of God. Find us on Facebook or visit our website at gamiabaptist.org.au. God bless.